This is Radio EcoShock.
What about this government bailout for GM, Ford, and Chrysler? Can these companies change fast enough to meet reality? Let's start out with a quick tour of clips from the testimony to the House about the bailout on December 9th. The Democrat from Massachusetts, Congressman Ed Markey, is the chair of the Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming. I like Markey. He's been battling it out on this pivotal committee through the indifference of the latter Bush days, plotting out a plausible future. The webcast was 2.5 hours long, and we just don't have that kind of time, so I've been quite selective. We'll start out with a couple of opening remarks by Chairman Markey, followed by the committee member from Washington State, Jay Inslee, and then clips of testimony.
A business model premised on bigger cars, wider highways, and more oil is a failed equation. Any recovery of these companies will require more than just fresh cash. It will require a change of culture, a culture that answers challenges with innovation rather than lobbying and litigation, a culture that tries new ideas rather than crushing them. I believe Detroit can be reborn. I have reviewed the pending draft legislation that would make available $15 billion in emergency loans and require the Big Three to withdraw pending lawsuits against the states that support adopting California's greenhouse gas emission standards. I commend that provision and strongly believe that Congress must go one step further and grant the waiver to California, which would allow California, along with 13 other states that want more efficient, less polluting vehicles, to require them.
That was Ed Markey. This is Jay Inslee.
We look at the Renault company that is signing contracts with the Better Place company that is now totally electrifying the transportation fleets of Israel, Australia, Denmark, and now San Francisco. We have to get in this game nationally, or we will be left at the starting post with bridges to nowhere. And so I want to point out that I am hopeful that this Congress will adopt the measures that will assure that the United States gets in this international game at the last possible moment. Let me give you an example why I think it's the last possible moment. We have a company that makes lithium-ion batteries in the Midwest, and right now it's the only potential manufacturer domestically of lithium-ion batteries. They got an offer for about $300 million from China to essentially move their company to China. We are in the cusp of trading addiction to Middle Eastern oil for addiction to Chinese lithium-ion batteries. So we need to make sure that this industry responds to this opportunity by going to the future, not being tied to the past. I've sent a letter November 17th. I'll submit it to the letter to Chairman Frank, suggesting six measures: an open fuel standard, investments in alternative fueling infrastructures, energy efficiency requirements, a cash for clunkers program, full funding for plug-in hybrid electric vehicles, and a federal procurement programs. Those measures will assure the United States it doesn't get left at the post in this international competition. Hope we'll get this job done. The future of this industry depends on it.
That was Congressman Jay Inslee from Washington State with his opening remarks to a hearing on energy independence and the implications of the auto bailout. Now we'll go to the first presenter, Joan Claybrook, from the public interest watchdog group Public Citizen, the one founded by Ralph Nader.
I was interested to note that just this week, General Motors published an ad in Automotive News apologizing to the public for its failure to carry out its obligations, really, to the public for fuel economy and other improvements in their vehicles. One of the most important things is that the auto industry has made promises to have all airbags in all cars by 1975, the president of General Motors, Ed Cole, said, promises to have greater fuel efficiency, all the auto manufacturers said in 2000, by 2005 they'd have a 25% increase. Then they didn't do it. And then they said they were going to have side-head airbags, and then they didn't do it. They did it in some vehicles. Again and again, there have been promises that have not been carried out. Anything that we want these manufacturers to do should be in the law. It has to be in the law, because if it's not done, then organizations like Public Citizen and NRDC and others can sue and force this to happen. And there won't be the delay that there traditionally has been when there have been promises and everyone's relaxed and said, great, they're going to do it, and then they don't do it.
That was Joan Claybrook. Next up is a bit from Ruben Munger, chairman of a startup independent automaker of electric plug-in vehicles called Bright Automotive.
Our flagship product, the first of several from a common platform, is a plug-in hybrid electric vehicle which will go for up to 100 miles per gallon. This is a 5 times improvement over the best-in-class competitor in our class. Bright is on track to be in production at an annual rate of 50,000 vehicles per year by 2012, and to grow from there. As a new startup, Bright will ramp to scale and do it immediately. Our focus is on optimizing platform physics. Beyond just an advanced powertrain, it is a combination of lightweighting, best-in-class aerodynamics, low-rolling resistance tires, sustainable materials, and that advanced electric powertrain that combine to provide truly breakthrough opportunities. The Green Car Factory Fund is cited in all of the plans of the Detroit 3 as a key component of funding their compliance with new efficiency regulations. Section 136 is a critical component of the transformation of the industry. As an example of that, Bright Automotive last week submitted our proposal for a loan under this fund. It is a critical component of the path forward for companies like us, as well as the big three.
We're doing a quick survey of clips about the auto bailout in testimony to a congressional committee. This is Dr. Peter Morrissey, professor of the International Business at the University of Maryland. He's less optimistic.
I would say this to you, that right now, as they stand, they are not competitive. They claim they will be in 3 or 4 years. I do not believe that on the basis of what they have shown me. I don't believe that giving them a bailout will make them competitive, no matter how many conditions that we attach. The Congress is very good at writing laws. I don't know that it's very good at the proceedings of a bankruptcy court. And what these industries need to do, these companies need to do, is to go through Chapter 11, or at least have the threat of Chapter 11 with regard to their stakeholders to bring them into line to get the results that they need. They just have too much debt and a labor agreement that doesn't work, and frankly, management that just doesn't see the future clearly enough, although there's considerable variability among the Detroit 3 in that regard. My feeling is as if you bail them out, they will politicize the process. They'll find some way around the restrictions on lawsuits and all that. They will find a way to lobby the system. If they don't do it, their union will do it for them. And we will end up, over time, with an industry that is still less cost competitive. And when we finally, after hundreds of billions of dollars, decide to cut them loose and go through Chapter 11, it will be a smaller industry than it will be is now, and we will save fewer jobs by reorganizing them. The sooner we give them the cure, the sooner the more jobs we will save.
Finally, from the design side of the car business, here is Dr. Jeff Wardle, Director of Advanced Mobility Research, Art Center, College of Design in Pasadena, California.
In our written testimony, we make 4 major recommendations on how to deal with the rescue plan for General Motors, Chrysler, and Ford. But we are here to confirm that the business model of the traditional American automobile industry is broken. The future of personal mobility is no longer just about cars. So insisting that the auto industry develops energy-efficient vehicles is by itself not an adequate prerequisite for financial assistance, in our opinion. I think it's fair to say, though, that the legacy auto industry does an exceptionally good job of designing, developing, and making vehicles that, unfortunately, people no longer really want. Meanwhile, there are startup companies like Tesla, Aptera, Bright Automotive, represented here, and Fisker, that are financially challenged to get products that Americans do need into manufacture and to market. So we would recommend using some of the bailout funds to deploy idle manufacturing capabilities of the legacy companies to enable the startups to get their already developed products to market sooner rather than later and on a meaningful scale. America's current transportation network is based on the Futurama vision that was showcased at the 1939 New York World Fair. We are now well overdue for a brand new Futurama vision, but a vision that does not rely on cheap energy, vast quantities of raw materials, destruction of natural habitats, and disregard for climate change, human safety, and quality of life. So we also recommend that some of the funding should go towards a far-reaching, nationwide, smart, and sustainable network of transportation systems. This will also provide much of the new business for an overhauled and revitalized Detroit, simultaneously providing a guaranteed customer for these new products that they would make.
You're listening to Radio EcoShock on Green 960 AM, San Francisco. You have just heard testimony to the U.S. Select Committee on Energy Independence and Global Warming, as webcast from globalwarming.house.gov. I've saved the first hour for you as an MP3 recording at ecoshock.org. Choose transportation from our free audio on demand menu, ecoshock.org. Look in the transportation section. I'm sure there are as many opinions on this Big Three bailout as there are listeners to this show. As an environmentalist, I'm mad as hell at Detroit. They fought off the very demands for fuel efficiency that would have saved themselves and the planet. While I feel for the workers and for the real families there, I saw strikes for more benefits, but no unions protested when GM started building 8-mile-per-gallon Hummers long after the truth about greenhouse gases and depleted oil reserves were well known. Even the last of the Ford family directors objected in a formal statement to the board regarding Ford's dependence on huge gas guzzlers for profits. Groups like Rainforest Action Network and innovators like Amory Lovins tried to work with these companies with no real results. Apparently, the American auto industry was determined to fail, and they've succeeded in doing that. My personal opinion, the bailout is a stall of the inevitable. These companies need to be either disbanded or nationalized. And if nationalized, their first step should be to stop producing cars. North America doesn't need another single oil-powered vehicle. We are already flooded with overcapacity in cars that can't meet the future. Detroit stopped making cars in World War II. They made Jeeps and trucks and airplanes and ship parts and whatever the country needed to survive. Now they need to make train cars, small electric plug-in vehicles, all sorts of personal transport devices, but mostly mass transit, and then more mass transit. Unused capacity could go into making the wind machines and solar furnaces we will need to survive the end of the age of oil, and especially the immediate end of coal. Otherwise, as strange as it may sound in a winter's blast, we'll find an overheated and wrecked world. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. EcoShock.org. Warning, the following sounds may irritate your brain. Do not panic. This is Radio EcoShock.
Frosty the Coleman is a jolly, happy soul. He's abundant here in America, and he helps our economy roll. Frosty the Coleman's getting cleaner every day. He's affordable and adorable, and his workers keep their pay. There must have been some magic in clean coal technology, for when they looked for pollutants, there was nearly none to see. Oh, Frosty the Coleman is a jolly, happy soul. He's abundant here in America, and he helps our economy roll. Thumpity thump thump, thumpity thump thump, look at Frosty go. Thumpity-thump-thump-thumpity-thump, towards energy independence we go.
Hey, kids, you remember Frosty the Coal Man, getting greener and greener each day. There must be some miracle, they say. Well, yes, indeed. The coal lobby that puts out these cheery Christmas mockeries needs a very big miracle in their stocking, because there isn't a single clean coal plant in the United States at all. No one captures and stores the deadly carbon dioxide that's wrecking the planet's climate, and as we'll find out today, not the radioactive waste either. They tried building one to get that carbon, but they gave up. And hey, that doesn't stop this front group of the Happy Coal advertisers singing a happy song.
Clean coal is here to stay. Fa la 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 la. Get cleaner every day. Fa la 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 la.
Did you know the coal industry is producing millions of tons of radioactive materials? Listen up. Our addiction to coal as an energy source has a hidden side effect. Over time, we are creating a huge radioactive burden on the land, sea, and air. Hundreds of thousands of tons of thorium and uranium, including enriched uranium, that could be used by terrorists, all from coal-fired power plants. Planet Earth is a radioactive place. That is why it is still molten hot at the core. Fortunately for life, almost all that dangerous radioactive material was left beneath a protective layer of rock. Humans insist on dragging these poisonous materials to the surface and pouring them out into the air for the insanity of nuclear weapons and reactors. But unseen beneath the surface of our energy economy, coal, too, is adding unbelievable amounts of radioactive waste to your lungs, country, and the global environment. Sometimes one enemy will tell you the real goods about another. The nuclear industry, that glutton demanding more public tax money, is anxious to tell us the real dirt about their competitor, Mr. Coal. Thus, the publicly funded Oak Ridge National Laboratory, infamous for nuclear mismanagement, hosts an article titled "Coal Combustion, Nuclear Resource or Danger?" written by Alex Gabbard. Gabbard's argument is simple. Coal plants emit more radioactive materials than well-run nuclear plants, he says. Sadly, as industry insider publication like Nucleonics Week report, there are no well-run nuclear plants. They all have breakdowns and some near meltdowns and regular radioactive releases beyond their published specifications. But let's take a closer look at coal with Mr. Gabbard. It takes a huge volume of coal to fuel each and every coal-fired power plant. As you know, entire mountaintops are removed, and giant craters are formed just to feed American energy needs. The majority of America's electricity is still generated by coal. Within all that tarry black rock is the usual scattering of radioactive materials common to Earth since the beginning of the planet. But what happens when that radioactivity is concentrated in the coal furnaces? Where does it go? According to Alex Gabbard, back in 1982, the typical coal plant released 12.8 tons of thorium, a radioactive agent known to cause cancer, particularly thyroid cancer. The coal power station also pumped out an astounding 5.2 tons of uranium. Worse, the burning process tends to concentrate the most unstable form of uranium, namely uranium-235, the fuel used for nuclear reactors and for making atomic bombs. The typical coal plant created 74 pounds of uranium-235. It takes as little as 55 pounds of enriched uranium to make an atomic weapon. We need to know where that potential terrorist gold mine goes. Gabbard's reasonable figures suggest the 174 coal plants in America of 1982 released 801 tons of uranium, including 11,000 pounds of uranium-235. Coal contributed another 1,971 tons of thorium that year alone as well. In 1982, the whole world burned an estimated 2,800 million tons of coal. That adds up to 3,640 tons of uranium, with 51,000 pounds of uranium-235 and 8,900 tons of thorium. In just one year, our coal habit produced more than 10,000 tons of highly radioactive material.
Plenty for years to come.
Coal burning has only increased in China and India since they came online with super-industrialization. Let's assume, by some miracle, the world manages to cut back by the year 2040 to just 2,500 million tons of coal, 10,000 tons less than was burned in 1982. There would still be a horrible radioactive legacy left on Earth. Between the years 1937, when such records began, and 2040, the coal industry would have produced 828,000 tons of uranium, including 5,883 tons of uranium-235, more than 2 million tons of thorium. Using government measurements, Gabbard estimates a release of 477 million millicuries just in the United States by 2040. Globally, almost 3 billion millicuries of radioactivity would be added to the world environment just by coal burning. And that's if we manage to cut back to pre-1982 levels, which certainly isn't happening now. Gabbard couldn't foresee the giant impact of China and India's coal burning, which has already bypassed the United States. China has far fewer scrubbers and other pollution controls. The real figures are much, much worse. How is this possible? Gabbard writes, quote, "During combustion, the volume of coal is reduced by over 85%. It shrinks, which increases the concentration of the metals originally in the coal. although significant quantities of ash are retained by precipitators, heavy metals such as uranium tend to concentrate on the tiny glass spheres that make up the bulk of fly ash. This uranium is released to the atmosphere with the escaping fly ash at about 1% of the original amount, according to NCRP data. The retained ash is enriched in uranium several times over the original uranium concentration in the coal, because the uranium and thorium content is not decreased as the volume of coal is reduced, end quote. That's because uranium and thorium are not burned. As the coal industry argues, in any particular year, a study of the radioactive emissions from coal plants would show levels lower than the natural background dose of the planet Earth. But, quote, because the half-lives of radioactive potassium-40, uranium, and thorium are practically infinite in terms of human lifetimes, the accumulation of these species in the biosphere is directly proportional to the length of time that a quantity of coal is burned, end quote. Every year we depend on coal is another year humans add more thousands of tons, more radioactive materials to the so-called background. Lasting hundreds of thousands of years, our radioactive legacy will outlast any human civilization. We will be known as the nuclear dumpers. Let's compare the radioactive burden of nuclear plants or coal plants to alternative energies like solar, wind, geothermal, or tidal power. It's a difference of night and day, a dark and scary night and day. What happens to this bounty of coal-borne radioactivity anyway? The majority of uranium is attracted to the tiny glass particles in coal emissions. About 99% of it is supposed to be trapped by smokestack traps and scrubbers, where they exist, and they don't in China, before they hit the surrounding air. That still means that people living near coal-fired power plants are bombarded with radioactive materials that escape, and not just locals. The uranium glass particles fly up into the upper atmosphere to be transported around the world. People in North America breathe in China's radioactive coal dust, and Europeans breathe in America's pollution. So do Canadians. There's enough particulate matter to form a dirty coal ring around the planet, a kind of radioactive smog laden with tiny heavy metal particles as well. What about the radioactive gunk collected by the scrubbers when they're there? Well, that's another odd angle to this story, hardly discussed outside of military circles. The concentration of uranium-235 in coal ash is strong enough to provide materials for nuclear weapons. And where are we dumping all this radioactive coal ash? Practically everywhere. Some has been shipped overseas. It has been dumped into the oceans. Most of it is piled unattended around our country. The radioactive material will never weaken in terms of human lifetimes. It can hardly be guarded. Yet it is a weakness in terms of national security for every coal-burning country. At least the nuclear guys give us another reason why coal is not the answer and not even a sustainable energy source for humans, even without the terror of carbon-based climate change.
Technology, technology, you make the coal burn cleanly. Technology, technology, you make the coal burn greenly.
That's another befouled Christmas classic brought to you by a desperate coal industry. Oh, clean coal technology, if only you existed. We are totally out of time. I'm Alex. Visit ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening. Next week, muchachos.